Okay. All right, Merle, go ahead and start by telling me again how you first came to Alaska, what brought you here.
Well, I came to teach, and there's kind of a story behind that, because I met Guy in Colorado when we were first working on our master's there, and he came up here to take a job with Fish and Game. We had dated some, and I went down to Texas and took a job in Texas. And I was down there for 3 years, and his job sounded exciting. Alaska sounded exciting, and so I applied for a job up here. And at first they told me that the gal who was in the home ec department, the job I had applied for, was going to stay. So there was no vacancy. And then a month or two later, I got a letter saying the vacancy had occurred and that I had the job if I wanted. So I came up here.
Good.
And at the time, the housing then was just as scarce as it is now. But Guy managed to locate an apartment for me. Actually, I house sat for a little while before the apartment was ready, but it was a brand new little one-room apartment over a garage. And so that's where I lived for the year that I taught. And then I went to Montana to teach mm-hmm. the next year. And then after I taught in Montana, Guy and I married, and I came back up here and have lived here ever since.
Okay.
And that was in 63 when I came up.
Okay.
The first time I came up in 61, mm-hmm. but I married in 63.
Mm-hmm. What was the population like at that time?
It was, I don't remember the numbers, but it was a small village community more than a real city.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the feel of a small community. You knew everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the type of community, if it was bad weather and you were walking downtown and the wind was really howling, taxis would stop and give you a ride if they were going that way. It was a real neat community.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned before that you said they had a lot more trees, or it seemed like there was a lot more trees.
Oh, there were definitely a lot more trees. I would often take walks and go away from town on mission. At the time, Rezanov was not there.
Mm, okay.
That has been added later. And then the cutoff was there when I came back. I don't remember that it was there when I was up here teaching. But when I came back, they were working on the cutoff. Of course, all of it was dirt. There was mm-hmm. there were no paved roads then, mm-hmm. except the main one that went out to the Coast Guard base.
Mm-hmm.
And I would walk out mission to the cutoff and then to Mill Bay and back into town. And all of Mill Bay area by the lake there mm-hmm. was covered with trees. And
oh,
now it's all a commercial area and you can hardly even find a tree.
Right.
And each year there are other areas that are cut down for building. But at that time, the road only went out as far as the cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
Mill Bay went out to Mill Bay, but not very much further.
Hi there.
Let's see. Did you let it come in?
I can let you in.
No, I probably don't need it.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. When you talked about the Coast Guard base, at that time it was a Navy base, is that correct?
There was a Coast Guard contingent here,
oh,
but the
okay.
main part was a Navy base.
Right.
And then I don't remember what year the Navy pulled out and left it with the Coast Guard, and then the Coast Guard expanded their first
right.
Navy.
In the 70s, I believe. And you said the gate was not where it is currently, right?
The gate at the time when I first came up here was right past Dead Man's Curve.
Okay.
Just right in the middle
real
of the
close.
Road. And in order to go out the road, you had to go through the Coast Guard base. You had to get a pass.
Mm-hmm.
Go. A lot of people went out hunting, and the Coast Guard even had a ski area
oh.
out there and maintained that.
That'd
and
be nice to have.
They left the civilians come and use it, and so it was really neat. So it was travel. The road was traveled well.
Mm-hmm.
But
was there housing out there, like Bell's Flats or Chiniac?
Not at Bell's Flats at that time. Mm-hmm. There was, well, I take that back. There was the one family that lived up there, and they were born, but it wasn't settled like it was now. Right. It was more just communication.
Right. So if you lived out that way, it would be easy for you to get past the gates and go on your way.
Oh, yeah. There was no, it wasn't really tight security right. that nobody could go through, but it mm-hmm. was just kind of a nuisance sometimes to mm-hmm. have to stop and get a pass.
Right. That was their property, and that's mm-hmm. mainly why they had it that way. Okay. Oh, okay. Why don't you tell me when you moved into this house currently on the channel? And
when we married, that's when we moved in here. Guy had bought this house the year before and had rented it out.
Mm-hmm.
So that when we married, we moved in here. At the time, it was just a one-story house on wooden pilot. And the following year, he decided that the foundation needed to be improved, and so while he was going to improve the foundation, he might as well raise the house and build another floor. So that's
right.
What happened.
So you've been here since
1963.
Okay, in this house?
In this house.
Oh, okay. And Marcy didn't live next door to you at that time?
No.
That was somebody else?
The Cuthberts.
The Cuthberts, yeah. Okay. And that's who the folks that you had gone over to see. At the time, you were over at their house at the time of the tsunami,
right?
Before.
Right.
Could you recount that story for me?
Okay. Guy was in Seattle on fish and game business. Actually, though, since it was the weekend, he was visiting friends mm. and playing golf in Washington area. And the Cuthberts had invited me over for Good Friday dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were over there, the earthquake occurred, and it was really, it was kind of like being on a rickety old merry-go-round. You could hear it all. There was this noise associated with it, mm-hmm. and the house just had that kind of shake that it felt like a merry-go-round.
Yeah.
But Jim Cuthbert had, his boat had been out of commission, and he went down to check on the boat, and the electricity was off, but they had a battery-powered radio, and just after he left the house, over the radio came the news that a tidal wave had, or a tsunami had hit Chiniac, and everybody should get to higher ground.
Right.
And so Molly had three-year-old and a nine-month-old, and she was pretty excited right then because her husband had just left.
Right.
But he was back in just a few minutes because the water had already gotten to town before he could get down there.
Did he tell you what had happened to the boat, or?
He didn't get as far as his boat.
Oh.
He just saw that the water had come in, so he came straight back to his family.
Right.
We all went up to the high school and waited until, I don't even remember how long, but we could see that the water just kept going back and forth and was not endangering our houses at all.
Mm-hmm.
So when that was evident, we just came back.
And they let you just go?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. What kind of things did you see that, you know, when you were up at the high school? And
well, you could see it was still light enough because this was in March, late March, and you could see pieces of the dock and airplanes and boats that were not in under power, just all sorts of things floating by, and then the sage from the tsunami would take them back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
From
it must have been scary.
Actually, I think like with anything, it's, you know, it's kind of, you're kind of in a state of numbness or shock or mm-hmm. this isn't even happening type thing, and it's not really as scary until afterwards.
When you,
you know,
realize
when you realize what, but okay. I don't remember being afraid, but mm-hmm. then later when the aftershocks, everybody in town, you know, if they were anywhere and there was a good sized aftershocks, they took the wherever they felt safe.
Right, thinking another tsunami
mm-hmm.
might come. Oh boy. Now, as far as the debris and the buildings and everything, that must have taken a long time to rebuild.
A very long time. Yes, a very long time. It took a long time just to clean up the town and
mm-hmm.
burn the junk that mm-hmm. was all in town. And
yeah.
And tear down the buildings that were damaged so badly.
Do you remember what any of those buildings were that were torn down? Any businesses that were pretty prominent?
Yes, there was a DNA. Donnelly and Atchison had a kind of a commercial company, and they sold everything. It was kind of like Krauss at that time. Mm-hmm. And Krauss was in three different buildings, but sold basically, you know, they had a clothing area, clothing, hardware, groceries. Mm-hmm. And DNA had about the same thing under one roof. And they were located right where the ferry terminal is right now. Mm-hmm. And the tidal wave just took them out completely. Mm-hmm. Took the main building of Krauss out. In fact, it might have taken all of them out, because they were built on piling out mm-hmm. over the water. And so all of those businesses that were on piling were either so damaged that they could be rebuilt or
were. Right. And there were boats that were way up.
Yeah, boats were just set up in town.
Did you lose anything? Personal belongings or boats or anything like that? That's good. Did you go take pictures?
Yes, I did. I was due with Tracy in 2 weeks, but I figured this, I had to get some pictures. And I found out that martial law had been declared, so I couldn't get into the area. So I had to climb up on the, up above the town where the, kind of behind the houses that were up there outside of the area of the martial law.
Pillar, are you referring to the
pillar? Yes, it would be up, it's so changed now that it's kind of, but it would be on the edge of pillar,
mm-hmm. okay.
looking down into town.
Right.
It took quite a number. And then when Guy came back, he was on part of the work crew that cleaned up, and he took quite a number of pictures down there.
Right.
And then we also went around town and took pictures in the same area of photographs that we'd taken just around town before. Just when I came up to teach, I took quite a number of pictures just to send back and show family what it looked like up here. So we would go and try to position the camera in the same place so we could have a before and after.
Right.
And some
right.
of those are in the hotel.
Oh, okay, at the Westmark. Yeah. Now, Guy must have heard this happen over the radio. Was there?
He
wasn't here.
He didn't hear it, but the people that he was visiting heard it.
Mm-hmm.
And the wife was in the kitchen cooking, I guess, and she heard it. So she, the news that went down to the South 48 was that a Kodiak Island had sunk, completely disappeared. So she called her husband in and said, "Should we tell Guy?" And he said, "Well, we've got to tell him." And so Guy's reaction was, it was evident he didn't believe that it had sunk.
Right.
And that if I was home where I was supposed to be, I'd be okay, because we were high enough out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And so he immediately sent a wire to my folks saying that I was fine. He had no idea what the situation was, but he figured mm-hmm. that they needn't worry until they found out the worst.
Right.
And so years later, my mom asked him, how did he know I was okay? And then he had to fess up to
he didn't know
the situation.
Oh boy. So when he came back, that's when you took some more pictures. And then were you involved in any, well, you were pregnant, so I don't know if you were involved in any cleanup or.
No, I didn't clean up
any. Yeah. So when did you have Tracy at that point?
Well, she was 2 weeks late, so it was actually May 1st before she came. She mm-hmm. was due the 16th but, of April, but she came on the 1st of May. So. Mm-hmm.
And not many people were having babies about that time?
There were no, I don't remember how many should have them about that time,
right.
because we had several when Tracy came along, but there were no babies born during the tidal wave.
Too scared to come out.
I don't know.
Usually it seems like you hear disaster and people have babies left and right, but it just had the opposite effect. So when you were teaching at the high school, how long did that period last until you started your family and then were at home to take care of them?
I just taught at the high school here when I was single.
Mm, okay.
Before we married. And then I went down and taught in Montana. After we married, the guy said I could teach him out whatever I wanted to, and mm-hmm. I decided I just wanted to be gone.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't teach until Wendy was in kindergarten.
Okay. And you taught at the college later, right?
Right. I went back and taught in high school for a couple of years, and then went on and taught in the community college for 3 years, I think. Part-time 2 years, and then it went to full-time, and that was the year the union came in, and we had a parting of the way because I disagreed with unions and service professionals.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Were there many women in Kodiak at that time? Was it pretty populated? You always hear about Alaska, all men, just a few women. And were there a lot of women working up here that you remember?
Well, I had quite a number of friends. Mm-hmm. I had two friends that came up as school teachers,
mm-hmm.
and it was their first year teaching.
Right.
And they were from New York City.
Oh.
And they came to Kodiak not mm-hmm. knowing what they were in for. And at that time, Pacific Northern Airlines was the only airline into Kodiak. It came directly from Seattle. And it came 3 times a week. And if there had been a plane back that day, I'm sure one of them would have gotten on it and gone back. But because she had to stay until another plane, she mm-hmm. had time to at least adjust to the fact that she was here and she could make
it. What do you suppose she didn't like about it? Just too different? Or?
Well, New York City, I'm sure, was quite different. And at that time, there wasn't, but the housing was really scarce. And they had to go to a hotel to live until something came up. And the hotel at that time was just a small, called the Kodiak Hotel, the only one in town.
Mm-hmm.
And the houses were not usually fixed up on the outside at all. It looked like a little junky town, a junky village, really.
Yeah.
But inside, the houses were really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once they realized that the town was made up of the people, not the houses.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, they taught in an elementary school that was housed in a Quonset hut right downtown at that time.
Really? That was it for the elementary school?
No, they had, that was part of the elementary school, mm-hmm. and then they had more of the elementary school. I might be wrong about that.
Was it part of the junior high at that time?
They probably didn't move that junior high until... That you may have to scratch, because
okay.
I don't remember what... But I do know that the elementary was down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that they also had... elementary up there, but it might have just been junior high and high school. But I think
okay.
they still have, but anyway, that's so fuzzy that it's not important,
right.
but the fact that they taught in the class.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do you feel like the women who came up here had to be a tougher breed to last in Alaska, or was it as different as people thought it would be?
I think the ones who came up were the adventurous type.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
like
think
you?
Anybody would have come up here without being that, unless they were married to a serviceman or married
sure.
to somebody who came up, you know, and had their family with them.
Right.
But singly. And they, because of the service here, I'm sure there was a larger proportion of males to females, but, you know, it wasn't that you were the only woman in town
mm-hmm.
or anything. There were families, and
right.
I never felt like it was really overpopulated when you're living.
Right. That's good. Well, all right. You hear all these men's stories all the time. I think we need some of the ladies' opinion here. I just jotted some things down so I don't get off the track, but why don't you start, Marcy, by telling me about how you first came to Alaska and how, why, when.
Okay, Harold and I were married in Los Angeles, and I was, 18 years old. We were married the day after I was 18. Mm-hmm. And so he and his brother, of course, both of them had just gotten out of service, mm-hmm. and they started reading some articles in the Los Angeles Times mm-hmm. about Alaska and opportunities of Alaska. So when we first got married, I was working at Smith Meter Company, and he was working at Goodyear Tire, mm-hmm. both mundane jobs, especially after since he had been in the Merchant Marine and oh. all over the world, you know. So he didn't think that was very exciting, and he and his brother decided they were going to come to Alaska. And by the time we sort of got around to it, I found out I was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, well, that's the end of that, because people in Alaska only live in igloos and burn coil-out lamps and no such thing as hospitals. So I figured, well, that was the end of that. But there were quite a few young people at the East Los Angeles Church of Christ, a big, big group of young people, mm-hmm. Young marrieds and unmarrieds yet, and college students, that they had come up to Juneau on a campaign to help establish the church there.
Oh.
So they were very familiar with Juneau. Now Juneau has a large congregation, but at mm-hmm. that time there wasn't a congregation of the Church of Christ. So they came up, and these were all friends of Harold's and his brothers. So mm-hmm. that's kind of got them interested too. So some of them came back, or wrote letters back, I guess, and said no, there was a modern hospital there. People lived in modern houses, and everything was just fine. But I still thought, oh no, I couldn't go. So Harold dropped the subject. Mm-hmm. But his brother and sister-in-law came on up, and they wrote back and said, everything's fine, come on. Well, my mother was dead set against it, and since I always obeyed my mother, I decided we were not going until one day my mother almost forbade me to go. And of course, I was married and 18, and I said, we are going. So that's the way we did.
That's okay. That. That set your mind.
Yeah.
What year was that?
1947.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because we were married in September 46, and I found out I was pregnant the early part of 47, so we came on up, and first baby was born in Juneau.
Oh, so how long did you live in Juneau? I didn't even know you lived in Juneau.
Oh yeah, we were there for, all three of the kids were born there. And I think we were there for 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went back down to Everett and bought a house. We had bought our boat on the GI Bill of Rights. So the, we bought our boat, we bought our business, and we didn't realize that you could buy either or a business or a house. We thought we could buy both.
Oh.
So we only used half of it to buy a business, fools that we were. And then when it came to buy a house, that we couldn't use a GI Bill, but in Juneau at that time, you either bought a mansion or you bought a shack. I couldn't afford a mansion, I didn't want a shack. So we went down to Everett, and we bought a house down there. And so then our life was from Pelican to Everett twice a year. I would completely move out of the house and rent it, mm-hmm. and get on the boat, and we'd go up with the kids in school in Pelican, until school was out, spend the summer there, put them in school, Pelican, and then in about October or November, take them out, go down to Everett, and put them in.
Oh.
But then the seasons started, there weren't any seasons at that time. You just fish as long as the weather would let you fish. Mm-hmm. We fished only salmon. And so later on, the kids, of course, were in, we built a house there. We lived in a tent at first. And
wow.
Built a house, and the kids really, it was just like a Tom Sawyer's paradise. You know, they just
this was
it.
In Pelican.
It's in Pelican.
Now help me with my geography. Whereabouts is that? Off the coast of British Columbia?
No. Oh. Pelican is just right out of Juneau. It's
oh,
just
okay.
about halfway between Juneau and Sitka.
Oh. Okay.
And it's on Chichikov Island, and the rather than going back to Juneau, when we went back up to fish, Harold was fishing out of Pelican, so we just started going out of Pelican.
Oh, okay.
And it was just a little Tom Sawyer's paradise. The kid, in fact, Chris has told me that he wished that he'd always wanted to have his kids have a childhood like he did.
Right.
Which I thought was pretty nice. And so then the kids got into the upper grades, so it was a little bit more difficult to take them out of school and put them back in. There wasn't a high school. Anita took her first year of the ninth grade from correspondence course.
Oh, really?
So that was kind of difficult. So then we started, the kids and I would fly down for school, mm-hmm. and Harold would stay there and fish until October, November, wow. bring the boat down, and because he had to work on it during the summer, and he usually worked in the shipyards. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd get a job during the winter because there was just wasn't enough money to mm-hmm. live all year.
Were there a lot of families doing that?
Uh-huh.
Moving yeah, and transient back and forth?
It was really a very fun type life because whenever we would travel, Harold would, we would travel only during the day on mm-hmm. a small boat with family board. And we would stop in different coves at night. We would try to make sure we always stopped at a different place where we'd never had been before. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of fun. We'd always mm-hmm. go ashore. And then later on, we always had our dog and our cat. And then we made one trip with two squirrels in a cage. And I guess that was... Oh, and we took a fur seal down with us
oh,
1 year.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we had a fur seal. Right. So we always had a life, well, fun on board. And then we had quite a few storms that, well, we told you about one that was really hair-raising.
Right.
That the
right.
engine went out. And I have been absolutely frightened within the inch of my life a few times. But Harold was always telling us, well, I like the story, it's always getting better, it's going to be better, don't worry about it, everything's going to be fine, which helped. If he had shown one little bit of fear, well, that would have been the end of it.
Right.
And then I didn't dare show any fear because of the kids. So we did a lot of singing. And oh, one of our favorite songs was The Old Rugged Cross. Uh-huh. And we sang that a lot, and we sang a lot of church songs, a lot of hymns. Like that's just about all we sing. So we sang, usually we sang all the way through a storm.
Oh boy, I'm sure that helped a lot.
Yeah, a whole lot. And then the when we were living in Pelican, well, even in Everett, I took care of other children and held down a job a lot of times. And then in Pelican, I would work, as when the kids got older, I would work in the office of the Pelican's cold storage, and I also worked in a store. 1 year I worked in the meat department, cutting up meat.
Wow.
That was fun.
Variety there.
And yeah, a lot of fun. And to get to the office to work 1 year, we couldn't get to our house except when the tide was out. We could walk across the tide flat. So I just started taking the skiff into the office and work, and then I'd go back in the skiff.
Now, Pelican, what kind of a... How large a community was that at the time?
Approximately 100 people during the winter, and it swelled about 300 during the summer. It was a thriving community. And a lot of fishermen would be in and out. You know, it's strictly a fishing village. And so they, and a lot of boats would deliver there who didn't actually stay there. They would just deliver and then leave. Mm-hmm. And they had a cannery and a cold storage, and eventually the cannery actually moved to Excursion Inlet. So they didn't have a cannery there after a while, but they did it first. A lot of people would come up. There was a Filipino community there, and we walked by the Filipino bunkhouse where they were doing our kitchen, you know, where they did their own cooking. The smells were wonderful.
Oh, I bet.
And we learned how to eat from the country. I raised a garden every summer. Little postage stamp garden, not any bigger than this kitchen, this little dinette, really.
Oh, yeah.
But we raised stuff that we, the more you pick, the more you could eat, like chard, kale. And we did raise beets, but we picked those the last.
Okay.
And then we ate the beets and, you know, the very last.
Mm-hmm.
Things that grew fast, lettuce, leaf lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
And we had pet sparrows just about every year. We would find little mm-hmm. sparrows that had fallen down and broken a wing.
Right.
So we had, usually we had, 1 year especially, we had two, and they had broken the opposite wings, so they held up each other.
Oh,
their little wings. Aww. And we kept those in a bird cage. Usually they didn't, you know, you could never turn them loose.
Right.
And they had to be fed constantly, constantly. So,
more than a little baby.
Yeah. It was, well, even when they got bigger, you know, they eat a tremendous amount.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get to keep them very long. So I told the kids no more sparrows. Too heartbreaking. But they had a, great horned owl, but the wingspread was more than 6 feet. It was a huge owl. And then we had, oh yeah, oh, they're big owls, beautiful and very gentle. Crystal has a scar somewhere along here on his nose where the owl was just reaching for the mouse that he had held for him. but he came a little bit too close. Oh, and he wasn't vicious or anything, he just pressed out too close to his face.
They have pet, you said fur seal?
Fur seal, an otter.
An otter.
A pet otter. Yeah. You name it, just about. We've had ducks. We had all kinds of ducks that they would bring home. The owl. One night, it was a beautiful, cold, crystal clear night. And we were sleeping on the bed, the couch in the living room, because it was very cold downstairs in our bedroom. We couldn't get the heat down there. So we slept on the couch in the living room during that winter and used the bedroom downstairs at during the summer. And the kids were in their room, and we, Harold one night heard a noise, and the owl was out in his cage, and he heard hoo-hoo, hoo-hoo, and he got up and looked out, and then there was another hoo-hoo, and a great horned owl had come and was sitting on the edge of the roof, and they were hooting
back and forth. Oh, let's see now. I'll just move along to some questions I had specifically for you. When you moved to Alaska the first time, was that a culture shock for you? Did you find
it somewhat different? Because I was, of course, still very young, and but we had instant friends, and that helped tremendously because there, like I say, this group was up there,
right?
And we helped establish a church there, and then my brother-in-law and sister-in-law were there, so that helped tremendously. And we got a nice big apartment, and all the church came over and helped us paint it, because I couldn't be around paint, you know, fresh paint, because I was pregnant. And the doctor was great, and it was somewhat of a culture shock, I guess, but it wasn't all that much. I was used to a lot of warmth, you know, Southern California, and all of a sudden it was raining all the time, and it was cold. But no, I guess I wouldn't say it was really, because it was fine, you know, so many people.
You were young and adjustable.
No, I don't really think it was. I couldn't think of it.
Yeah. Now, you said Harold was fishing salmon at that time?
We bought our boat in Kodiak. I mean, in Juneau. Okay. No, he had never fished before, but he was in the merchant marine.
Okay.
And so he knew about boats.
Right.
And then we bought a boat. In fact, Sunday afternoons was always walking up and down the docks in Juneau, and we found this boat that, in fact, we found two. And so we bought it, and we went fishing. But he had never fished on another boat.
Now, did you go with him at that time?
Yes, I did. He went out, first of all, he went out halibut, and he took a fellow with him who had done halibut fishing. And then I went out fishing with him, and of course, knowing absolutely nothing about the water, knowing absolutely nothing about boats, I was too stupid to know when to be afraid. So I would just go right out there in the storms, or even I didn't know a bean about anything.
So you weren't seasick?
No, never was seasick. But it was getting, let's see, I didn't go when I was pregnant with Anita. I didn't go until I was pregnant with Chris. And then, of course, that's when we had that accident. After I'd been out fishing all summer with Harold. But I started getting, it was getting a little bit hard for me because I was getting pretty far along. So I had gone in on the mail boat into back to Juneau from Pelican. And then he came in. He and Dick came in to see us, you know, like he was telling the story. And then we had that accident. And after that, I was very afraid of the water. And I would not even go walk down the boat harbor for a year.
Would you mind recounting that story again?
Oh.
I only remember some details about it, but, you know, a few things about it.
I'll just be brief. Yeah, we, Harold took the boat to Auk Bay. And, of course, there were no radios in those days. We did, I didn't know he was coming or anything. And he and Dick hitchhiked into Kodiak. And by that time, we were living in a not very nice apartment up on the first one. It was a big one. It was froze to death. We just about froze to death. So we got this smaller apartment up on the third floor. And it was only, it wasn't very nice, but it was
work. Now, is this here in Kodiak or Juneau?
Juneau. Okay. It was still in Juneau. And so he came into Auk Bay, and at that time you couldn't go from Auk Bay to Juneau, actually, without going around Douglas Island. So we decided to make it a picnic. And so after church, I had packed a picnic lunch. We took the baby and Dick and his girlfriend, Mary, and got on the Tacora in Ott Bay. And it was beautiful weather, very nice weather. And we told everybody, well, it'll only take a little while. We'll be back to church that night, which was our full intention. But about halfway around, and, you know, we had no barometers. We didn't have anything in those days. We didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. A compass, maybe, if it worked right. And they didn't have such things as weather forecasts and so forth for Marines. So we got about halfway around when here came bad weather, and it kept getting worse and getting worse and getting worse. And I put the baby into her bunk that Harold had built her up at the pilot house. And the pilot house was only 6x6. It was a little tiny pilot house. So I had put her down, and I went below. That's when we, all the bunks were down below it, though, in those old trollers that way. Later, we rebuilt it, and of course, everything was real modern. But at that time, all the bunks were down below, three of them. So I went down, and I got into the bunk, and Harold and Dick and Mary were all up at the pilot house looking where we were going, and the baby was asleep in the pilot house. So I was sleeping, and the next thing I heard was Harold yell down there something, but I didn't wake up. In a few minutes, he came down the steps, or down the ladder. It's called on a boat. There's never stairs on a boat. It's always a ladder.
Oh, okay.
So he came down the ladder, and he said, get up and get dressed. We've been hit. The boat's sinking. So I got up, and I ran up the ladder, and I felt in the baby's bunk, and she wasn't there. And I said, where is Punky? We called her Punky. Where is Punky? And he said, don't worry about the baby. Just get into the skiff. Well, he might as well told me to fly the moon without any wings, because I wasn't going to leave without my baby. You know, I just, and of course, I was pregnant with the second baby. This was in... I think it was in either September and October, and he was born in December, so it was pretty late pregnancy.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty late during my pregnancy. Yeah. Anyway, I just stood on the deck, and I went back again. I felt around her bunk, and she wasn't there. And so I came out and said again, and I think it was Dick who said, she's already on the other boat. Get in the skiff.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Harold had put her onto the other boat as the two boats slapped together.
Mm-hmm.
And but, I, you know, I didn't know at the time. So I did get into the over the rail. I crawled over the rail, and I just stood there. It, when I got in the skiff, I just stood there. I wasn't fully awake, or I couldn't figure out what was going on, or something. It was kind of rummy. And so Dick pushed me and told me to sit down. And then he and I went hand over hand from one side of the boat around to the other side of the boat. And as we were going up the other side, our hands were getting wet from the stern going down.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of got up on the other side of it. And he said, Harold, you better jump. She's going down, and we've got to get away from here. So Harold was up on the bow. I could see him with a line in his hand. And he later I found out he was calling to the other boat, come and I'll throw you a line. Well, I looked at the other boat, and it was headed toward Juno. You know, I could tell that it was heading away from us.
Mm-hmm.
But they had decided that there were no survivors. So they were going on to town without us. So Harold jumped in the skiff, and the oars had flowed away, and they were paddling away from the boat as it was going down. And I looked back over my shoulder, and it struck me. I can still remember. Well, it is just like in the movies, because just as I watched, all the lights were on, of course, every light on board was on. And all of a sudden, of course, it was about half under, and all of a sudden, the bow just shot way up in the air, and then it slowly went down, and I could see the lights way, way underneath the water. And I kept saying, yeah, the boat really does go up, just like in the bow really does go up in the air, just like in the movies. It's funny what could go through your mind.
Yeah.
So then they didn't know how far offshore, you know, it was before radar or anything. They didn't know how far offshore we were.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept paddling with their hands, and Carol said something, we don't want Marcy to get in that water, because he knew I would, you know, that's cold water and lose the baby. So they started paddling what they thought was toward shore. And again, the boat kept going toward Juno.
Mm-hmm.
We found out later, Mary Daroff, who was on the boat, told the captain that she saw us get into a skiff, turn around and go look for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we owe our lives to her. She persuaded them by screaming and yelling and crying and kicking and I don't know doing what all. The boat did turn around and they came and they picked us up. And I remember Harold saying, well, if that hawser had hit us, it would have sunk us. They threw us a great big line rather than, and he told them, no, send us a smaller line.
Mm-hmm.
So we got on, and just as we got on, the skiff disappeared. It went under. So we got on just in the nick of time.
The skiff you were in?
The skiff we were in disappeared. It went down. So anyway, the next, they helped me aboard, and they took me down below, and they had coffee fixed, and they had Anita down there. The baby was down there. And I remember saying, I will never, as long as I live, ever go aboard a boat again.
And did you?
Oh, yeah. But I did for a long time. I was afraid of the water. So then I wanted to go south. I wanted to see my parents. I hadn't seen them for a long time.
Whoa.
I wanted to go down to see my folks.
Yeah.
And this was after the second baby was born and the third baby, and we were living in a little house for that time.
Right.
It wasn't ours. We were renting. And I wanted to go home very badly. I really wanted to go home. And we didn't have the money to fly. And Harold says, well, we don't have the money. We didn't have the steamships. We didn't have the money for the steamship. The only way you can go home is get in the boat, and I'll take you to Seattle, and we'll get on down from Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the time I went back on the boat. And we traveled with another boat called the Helmar. And it was a nice yacht-type boat, but they fished on it. But the living quarters were beautiful. Ours was all just boat, just fish boat. And the living quarters weren't all that comfortable. But the Helmar had a piano aboard. And they were a very musical family. The father played the violin. The mother played the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And the two daughters played accordions. So every night we would tie up. We would have popcorn. They would play their instruments, and Harold and I would sing.
Mm-hmm.
So we just had a beautiful musical evening.
Yeah.
And they didn't play just any, they played beautiful music. They'd play even Chopin, Rachmaninoff, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. I thoroughly enjoyed it. We did enjoy that trip. So after that, well, then we started making these trips up and down, and we did buy the house in Everett, and I'd already told you that.
Mm-hmm.
So we went up and down and lived that life until 1967, when Harold bought a bigger boat and came up to Kodiak for the shrimp. And we liked Kodiak very much, and we moved up here actually permanently in 1970.
Oh, okay. So
we had been here before, but then we moved up to know that this is where we were going to live.
Mm-hmm.
In 70.
So you said Harold was fishing shrimp at that time when you came to Kodiak?
He came up with a shrimp boat. Oh,
okay.
And the first time we came was in 1967, and the company we fished for went bankrupt, so we didn't have a market. So then we went to the Oregon coast,
mm-hmm.
and we fished on the Oregon coast, and then eventually got back up here, but not with that boat. In the mm-hmm. meantime, we had sold one of the partners died. We were in partnership. One partner died, and so we got rid of that boat.
Oh, okay.
And then eventually, though, he ran the Orion. And the Orion is still floating around
here. Yes, I've seen it.
Yeah. He got a job running the Orion. He had had his foot broken. And so he was still limping when he went aboard the Orion. Came up here and was fishing shrimp out of Jap Bay. Well, by this time, of course, the kids were in college. I think Tony was in his first year of college and so forth. By the way, Tony went to high school here in Kodiak one year,
yeah.
or part of a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came up here to Jap Bay. Anita went over to Germany to be with her husband. She was expecting a baby by that time, and
mm-hmm.
Kelly was born in Germany. And both boys were up here fishing with Harold. And I thought, why am I in Everett all by myself? This is ridiculous. So without saying anything to anybody, I hopped on the plane. And of course, I knew Merle,
uh-huh.
and I knew the Edna and Duncan Fields. And I knew a few people around town that I had met, you know, in 67 when I was up here. Mm-hmm. And so I hopped on the plane without saying anything to anybody. And the boat wasn't in town. So I stayed in town for a couple of days, two or three days,
mm-hmm.
And was standing on the dock when he came in.
Aww. Let's see. I was going to ask you, we were on the subject of shrimp. Harold was on the Orion, you said. Mm-hmm. And then he didn't have your boat at that time?
No, this is before we bought the Martha J.
Oh, okay.
But when I was down there by myself, one reason I didn't want to be alone is our 25th wedding anniversary. So I was standing on the dock surprising him.
Mm-hmm.
It was real strange. Before he came into town, he said, Chris and Tony, I guess, were both on the board. At least Chris was. I don't know where Tony was. He said, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Mom's not standing on the dock when we got there. And I had not said anything to him nor to anybody else. And so he had made that statement. And when he got out a little bit from B&B Fisheries dock,
mm-hmm.
You know, I stood there. And neither one of them acted surprised to see me. Just like I'd been there all the time.
Why?
Because Harold had made the statement, I wouldn't be surprised. And sure enough, I was there. It was our 25th anniversary, but he couldn't leave the boat. So I celebrated my 25th anniversary sitting on the edge of the boat watching him and Met. That's how we celebrated.
As close as you could get.
And then I went out with him on a trip. And then when I came back, this was in 70, when I came back, I was getting ready to go back to Everett.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my ticket and everything, and I was sitting up in one of the small offices at B&B, getting ready to call the airport, and Bix Bonney walked by and he says, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting ready to go back to Everett. He says, why? And I said, I don't know. And I thought to myself, yeah, why? If Harold is here, why do I have to go back down there just to babysit a house?
Mm-hmm.
So I walked down the street and my friend Dorothy Painter picked me up. Wanted to know if I needed a ride anywhere, and I said, yeah. And I told her I was thinking about staying here, and she says, you can live in my trailer, in Jackson's Trailer Park, for the winter, because we're leaving, and you can just stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. We stayed there all winter. But anyway, I kept on. I said, well, fine, I'll just get out here. And then the next day, she let me off where I was going, I guess, the grocery store. So the next day, Chris had an question on his settlement from the trip that we had just taken.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jay Hadu had done the settlement. So I called Jay Hadu and I was asking her this for Chris because he didn't have time. So I was asking her, you know, what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And during our conversation, she says, you're a bookkeeper, aren't you? And I said, well, I'm far from being an accountant, but I said, I can keep books if people show me what they want. I said, I have done it, but it's very simple books.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, a friend of mine is looking for a bookkeeper. Why don't you go over and see him? It was Wayne Katula at the Mirror.
Oh.
So I walked into the Mirror, and Wayne says, well, how long are you going to be here? And I said, well, you know fishing. I don't know if I'm going to be here 2 months or if I'm going to be here 20 years. You mm-hmm. know how fishing is. And he says, well, take your coat off and go to work. So I went right to work right then.
Oh.
So we were settled.
Yes.
The longer
officially.
We were here, the better we liked it.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I had just left the house. And so I called a friend of mine, and she went over and packed up some of my clothes and set it up to me and locked the door for me. And it stayed locked for quite a while until, I don't remember, I think I had somebody else go and clear the house out and rented it out for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tony went down there one time and put all the furniture in storage, and a lot of it's still in storage.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't remember what was in that pile? That'd be interesting.
A lot of
treasure to unearth.
Yeah.
Now, at that, during that time when you were going out on the boats with Harold and those kind of things, that was several years that you were doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Were there mm-hmm. many women doing those kind of jobs?
Down in out of Pelican, there were families.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of people had swings for the children up on the boom.
Oh, yeah.
On the larger boats.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it was not real common. I mean, a lot of them didn't, but quite a few did. The families went out. It was a family-type fishing.
Right.
And then when I came up here, I went out with Harold every summer shrimping.
Mm-hmm.
I was always out on the boat with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it nice for him because, you know, over the years, even traveling back and forth from Southeast Alaska, from Washington, Southeast Alaska, he could take a nap. I could run a course, you know, and I would just steer the boat. And eventually we got fathometers,
right.
you know, so
right.
that helped. And he would tell me how far to stay off the shore. And I got to where I'm not a very good judge of distance, but I could run the course.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tell me at a certain time when to change the course. I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you ever have any hair raising experience while he was sleeping and mm-hmm. you were in charge?
Yeah, I did. And I screamed for him to get up there. But I'll tell you, I watched so carefully that I don't believe in reading in the pilot house. When you're mm-hmm. up there watching that boat, you better be up there watching where you're going.
Right.
And then when we got the Marcy J, we would run back and forth quite a few times, you know, from the shipyard. I stood watch. It's interesting, too, because sometimes some of the crew members would resent it. Now, here I'd been on a boat, you know, for a lot longer than they had.
Right.
But because they were the crew,
mm-hmm.
macho men, they figured I didn't know beans about anything. And so I had, you know... I contended with that a little bit. I never said anything.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But one time I remember in particular, there was a guy. I was just standing up there. Harold was taking a nap. And I was standing at the pilot house at Mars J. And this guy was sitting at the seat. You know, he was supposed to be on watch. I was just happened to be up there. And anyway, he got too close to something or something had gone wrong. I can't remember what. And he didn't know what to do. So I reached over and turned off the pilot, you know, so you take over by hand. I mean, that was the most simple thing to do. Man, he blew apart.
Oh, no.
He was the one who was supposed to do that. So when Harold came up, which he did, you know, when anything changed, he came up from the captain's stateroom. You know, I told him what I had done, and he says, that's exactly right. That's exactly what should have been done. So I felt better. But the guy resented it. And over the years, we have had... few of them I would go on a boat
mm-hmm.
at first. After I started gaining weight, I quit.
Mm-hmm.
But at first, I would do all the cooking. And occasionally, I would find a crew member that would resent that because
really?
He was the cook and he wanted to cook. And so after a while, though, I would get to where I would go on the boat and I would not lift my hand to anything. I just let them do it. I did
mm-hmm.
not tie it up. I did not cook. I was there to read books and to sit and sing with Harold and enjoy conversation in the pilot house.
and
that's what I did after a while.
Did that last very long, or is that when you started
until
to stay at home?
Until the shrimping quit. Yeah, I
when did
that
you
all
eventually decide you didn't want to do that anymore, go out on the boats?
When the shrimping quit, because I've never gone king crabbing.
Oh, okay. What year was that when the shrimping quit?
I can't even remember. I'll have to ask
you. You've been off the boat a long time.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'll have to ask Harold what year that was. Harold? Approximately 1981.
Oh, okay. And that's when you started staying at home and running things from home?
Mm-hmm.
And what is your current position here,
Marcy? Oh, my current position. To be real fancy, I got a call from an architect's secretary.
Oh.
The other day, and she said, I am this guy's administrative assistant. And I thought to myself, no, you're not. You're just his secretary. But if that makes you happy, be happy, you know. So I am, I don't know what I am.
You're Harold's administrative assistant.
I guess if I want to sound real fancy, I'm his administrative assistant.
So you run the books and the bills?
I do all the books. And have it on computer,
mm-hmm.
and I have someone to help me now because it was getting to be too much with two boats.
Mm-hmm.
I was just working. Now I work never over at the in the office. I never work over 4 hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now that might be 7 days a week, but
right.
it's not over 4 days, four right. hours a day. I refuse to do it anymore.
Right.
But I was working up to 8, 10, 12 hours a day.
That's for the Marcy J and that needed
you. Yeah, just getting to be too much. So. I pay all the bills, and when Harold is out on the boat, which last year he was, and even if he's gone to the shipyard, and he's been gone up to 5.5 to 6 months at a time,
mm-hmm.
you know, I take care of all the calls that come in. If there's something I can't handle or they want Harold to handle it,
mm-hmm.
then of course I tell him, well, I'll get hold of him and I'll ask him what he wants, and then I'll, or else I'll have them call him,
right,
or something like that, which is kind of strange sometimes because, especially stockbrokers, they don't usually want to talk to me. They want to talk to Mr. Harold Jones, and which is fine with me, I don't care. But Harold always says, you take care of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so one time, one guy almost got rude. I don't know if he realized I was his wife or he thought I was his secretary or something. I have no idea. Anyway, he says, well, I want to talk to Mr. Jones. And I says, well, you can talk to him all you want. But I said, I'm the one who makes out the checks, so you had better talk to me.
There you go. And
so,
did he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He calmed right down. He was really nice.
One last question I was thinking of. Since you came up here in 42?
No, 47.
You were in Juneau when Alaska became a state, were you?
Actually, we were, when that actually came about, as I recall, we were on the boat traveling from Everett to Pelican.
Oh, do you remember hearing things about it?
Yeah, by that time we had a radio.
Uh-huh.
And we heard the events over the radio.
That must have been interesting.
I can't remember what the year it was. What year did we become a state?
1957?
Was it 1957? See, we had moved out to Pelican by that time.
For my final. well, did you, when you got back to Juneau, did you notice, was anything different? Were people flooding into Alaska you noticed?
The first thing I noticed when people came up here a lot, so used to, you had to either fly or you came by Alaska Steamship.
Mm-hmm.
And Alaska Steamship was no longer in business, and a lot of people, especially young men, would come up on Alaska Steamship by steerage. They didn't pay as much money. We came up on Alaska Steamship our first, and we had a nice stateroom, but you know, it was fairly inexpensive travel.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I noticed, though, seems to me that the greatest influx of people was when the ferry started, and I can't remember what year that was, because for a long time there was no ferry out in Pelican.
Okay.
There is now.
Okay.
But it seems to me that opened a lot of accesses for a reasonable price,
mm-hmm.
that wasn't here before.
Right.
And in some ways that's good, in some ways it isn't.
Right.
You know?
So what ways would you consider?
Good.
Good.
Well, I think it's wonderful for tourists and people who, you know, families who want to get their families up here and who want to make, you know, for people living here who want to go out for trips.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to take their campers or everything, I think that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's great that they have a program for their senior citizens.
Mm-hmm.
The bad part, I think, it has opened up to, it seems, and maybe it would be no different, but it seems that it has opened up the bad part to the drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just coincidental,
mm-hmm.
but people can get up here very easily that way.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, it may be just coincidental. It just seemed to me that that was opening, mm-hmm. a lot of transient type, mm-hmm. people who were not really wanting to make Alaska their home. They were just
coming up here.
And
make some money.
And then just leave all the taxes to us.
Oh.
But my philosophy is, I'm going to start over again.
Okay.
But wherever Harold is, that's home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when Harold first started to get his boat, and it was only a 38-footer,
right.
his first boat, several, and I was pregnant, and I was only 18.
Right.
And several friends would say to me, don't let Harold get that boat. Talk him out of it. And I, even though I was 18, I thought to myself, I probably could. I could probably turn on the tears and no, I didn't want to, and he would not have done it, mm-hmm. if I didn't want him to,
mm-hmm.
and he would not have owned a boat. But I thought to myself, he is going to be the one to be the bulk of the breadwinner. And I want him to be happy. I have seen men very unhappy in their work. And I want him to be happy in his work. And I never want him to feel that he could have done something if I hadn't stopped him. Mm-hmm. I didn't want that responsibility. So I adopted the philosophy. He is the head of the family. It will be the main breadwinner. And so it is my duty and my privilege to help him in any way I can. And that's mm-hmm. always been my philosophy, and I have always done so. That's so beautiful. If it takes to, whatever it takes to help him do whatever he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And I think I am married to a truly happy man.
Well, he looks happy to me. Yeah. He's got you.
But a lot of people, you know, haven't you known men who hate their jobs?
Yes.
And I just don't want that. No. You know, I never did want it. So, and I don't mean that it's always been a bed of roses. It certainly has not. Mm-hmm. My goodness, we lived on $3,000 a year when everybody else was living on 10.
That wasn't during King Crab.
Huh? No, that was before.
I bet you saw some changes with the different fisheries.
Yeah,
changed hands.
The reason I've always worked is it was hard to make a living trolling. Mm-hmm. And so I did everything I could to help, you know, help feed and clothe the family.
Right.
Yeah. It was just a bare living, but it was a different living. I had one friend to tell me, you live rather a bohemian life, don't you?
Bohemian?
I thought, this was an older lady, and I thought about that a little bit. I said, yeah, I guess we do. I guess that's what we live.
The definition of bohemian, huh?
Yeah, but it has not been easy. A lot of people think fishermen make a lot of money, but I'll tell you, we've paid our dues.
Right.
Because a lot of people have something, you know, a lot that I have done without for years, that a young couple getting married now decides it's their due. I mean, they deserve having a washer and dryer. And I wash diapers in a number 2 tub mm-hmm. and in the bathtub. And I rinse, even after I got a washing machine, I rinsed them in a bathtub. Oh, and our troller, you know, it had sticks going out like this for the trolling pole.
Right. Yeah.
Harold fixed up a line that would go back and forth, and we would be trolling along with diapers flapping in the breeze.
Oh, you must have pictures of that.
I have somewhere.
Yeah.
They're downstairs somewhere.
The fishing family. Yeah. And now your sons are fishing.
Both of them are fishing, and they seem to like it. Mm-hmm. Chris wants his sons to go into fishing, but they are not inclined to do so. Mm-hmm. And Kelly has made money to go to college, but he has said he does not want to be a fisherman. Be my guest. Whatever they want to do is fine with me. With Harold, he loved the sea. He was in the Merchant Marine when we met. Mm-hmm. He loved the sea, and if he had been in the Merchant Marine, he would have been gone for, you know, months and months. And he decided fishing was the way he could be his own boss to a certain extent,
right.
And he could have the sea, and he could have his family. Mm-hmm. And so that's what it worked out.
That's a great combination.
Yeah, it really
that's a great ending to
worked out okay.
Interview.
How Harold and I have, you know, we've been married 45 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have contributed part of our marriage success, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that a little bit, but Harold and I promised each other before we were married. We'd never had an argument, and we didn't know each other very long before we were married.
Right.
We'd never had an argument, but we knew we would. So we promised to take the scripture of two scriptures, never letting the sun go down on your wrath. And then this was not a scripture we just agreed on, never to leave each other's presence while we were mad at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we have always lived by that, and it works. And another thing, we believe in prayer. I am a great believer in prayer, and Harold is too. And before we do anything, or when my sons are out, I pray for them constantly, and I pray for Harold. And while I don't believe that God makes things necessarily happen, I do believe he listens to our prayers, because of prayer of a righteous man availeth not much. So I pray for them constantly when they're out there. And I believe he, let's see, there's a scripture that you give to the Lord and he shakes it up and you receive much more than you ever give.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in that thoroughly. And I think that I have received a lot, not necessarily materially, but other ways.
Right. Thank you very much.
So that's been my philosophy.
All right.
And that's what you
learn from that. You want to keep going?
No, I'm all finished. Oh, okay. If you are.